From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for October 2nd, 2016. Yes, the first Sunday of October, and boy, you can sure feel that fall is in the air. Well, welcome to our look back at the week in politics, as well as what lies ahead in this last full month of campaigning before the November 8th election. So it's time to grab the Sunday paper, pour that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week started off on a great note. Well, I really feel bad that I can't stay awake for these great Saturday night college football games. And, you know, Sam, that Clemson-Louisville game, I was asleep at halftime, and that star quarterback of Louisville was just getting jammed by Clemson's defense, and he's averaging like 5 touchdowns a game, I think, going into this game. And so I completely missed the second half, only to read about, I think he had like 400 yards in the second half.
Yeah, they diced him up in the second half. It was actually a really close game. It was back and forth, and I believe, if I pull it up now, it was 36-28, and then Clemson scored the last 2 touchdowns. And then stop Louisville like at the 10-yard line to win the game.
Yeah,
so and it was back and forth the whole night.
I think it was a fourth down play with Louisville driving at the end.
It was fourth and 12, and they got 11.
Right, and of course, it was fourth and 12 after a penalty, and that was one of the problems that plagued them all night long because it was so loud in that Clemson stadium that there were so many illegal procedure calls and that kind of thing against the offense because, I mean, they even lost a fumble on a snap count that went awry. But what a great game. I, on the other hand, and I never did see the final score of this, since I have a great affection for Missouri and the Mizzou Tigers playing LSU, which I also have great affection for, and that's, of course, the LSU Tigers. So that was my sure bet yesterday, was watch that game and go Tigers.
Didn't really work out. 42-7 LSU.
Well, I figured as much because my youngest daughter, now a graduate of the University of Missouri, just texted me with one word that said "yikes." So I kind of got the impression that Mizzou actually didn't carry through. But you know, hey, we've got preseason hockey going on, and the Blackhawks finally scoring a preseason goal last night against St. Louis,
and winning 4-0.
Yeah, well, and I have to say, I went to the very first Wednesday preseason opener, and you know it's preseason when you're seeing a lot of players wearing numbers 60 through 70. It's you know, it was a good prep for seeing what the Rockford Ice Hogs are going to be fielding out there in Rockford, and go Ice Hogs. But you know, it's fun to go to a game like that, and you know me, I'm probably one of the worst people to go watch a hockey game with because I just am so focused on the action. Dave can certainly attest to that.
I had a great time with you going to a couple of games.
But you know, I'm not.
Oh, it's intense? Yes. But, you know, that's great to be around a fan who's involved. I like that.
But for preseason, it was fun because you care, but you're not worried about the outcome. So in a way, you can kind of enjoy the game. You can enjoy seeing some of these new kids playing.
Does that mean you don't enjoy it during the regular season because you're too wound up?
Well, yeah, there are times.
Sure.
There are literally times I have to, you know, walk away from the radio.
Yeah, there's going to be some of those moments here as the Cubs go into the playoffs now.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of those.
Yeah.
A lot of those. Yeah, it's good to see. And the Hawks, I believe they're playing Detroit this evening.
Yep, 5 o'clock on the road in Detroit.
Yes.
So, I mean, all great tune-ups. And I will tell you one thing, even though, like I said, not that I didn't care about the outcome, but Scott Darling is having a really wonderful preseason, and you know, that opening night, the Hawks actually had a great first period, and I think they were, this was against Pittsburgh, 13-3, they outshot Pittsburgh in the first period. They end up getting outshot in the end, but Darling made 33 saves in a 2-0 loss, but one spectacular save, and this is the reflection of how I think the sport has changed so much, because the goalies are the big, tall guys now, and Darling made this miraculous save off the tip of his skate, a toe-tip save, that was just absolutely phenomenal, and it's good that he's getting some reps in, some game-quality reps in, and I'm getting ready for the season.
It does help when you're bigger than the net, that's for sure. He's only 6'6 and 235 pounds. By the way, you guys will really appreciate this. I stumbled upon a political event on, I think it was Thursday, at Harry Carey's, and a lot of the people were saying that they love the show. They listen to the show every Sunday, and they love Schwani, and they love the rapport.
We love them.
The funniest part, though, was somebody was like, yeah, the Sunday swim. Yeah. Yeah, I listen every Sunday.
Well, that's because I give pool reports, you know, on some of the – how about that? You know, I have to do presidential pool reports.
I figured you'd get a kick out of that.
Sunday swim. Okay.
Now we need water sound effects.
And then at that point, you don't correct them. You're just like, yeah.
Sunday swim.
There have been a few times I've been drowning in this studio a couple of times.
With Nick Pearson.
Well, that's great, and we thank everybody for listening.
Nick
and,
Pearson.
Notice I just went right by that one. I'm not going to dignify that response, Mr. Pinyatovich. It's a fun show to do. We always have a great time, and you know, next Sunday is going to be an interesting day in Chicago, because we've got the Chicago Marathon is next Sunday. So the roads are going to be messed up. It'll be interesting to get Dean Richards' take on how he gets to the studio. It's always a good story.
Did you hear the idea he put forward last week?
I did not.
They should do this at night. They should do it. They should start the marathon at like 1 a.m. And so by 6, 7 o'clock, things are starting to wrap up. Well, and would alleviate some of the traffic problems.
I'm for that.
That was his idea.
Okay. I you know, it'd be a little cooler to for the runners and that kind of thing. But no, it's a marathon, not a triathlon.
Let's just plunge right
wrong
in.
Button. Sorry.
Just plunge right in, shall we?
Oh, man. We've already lost control 15 minutes into the show.
16 minutes.
Well, speaking of sports and politics, well, first, next Sunday. So you have the marathon, plus, I don't know if this is widely known, but we have our hometown president has decided to come home next weekend, starting on Friday and leaving back in Washington for Washington on Sunday afternoon. So we'll have those kinds of traffic issues to deal with as well. Plus, we'll have Cubs probably postseason playoff game going on at the same time. So be an interesting day. But speaking of that intersection of politics and sports, my buddy Mark Sapelsa at Channel 9 posted this on Twitter, that apparently during the Monday night presidential debate, a number of people apparently confused the Cubs pitcher John Lester with Lester Holt and were sending John Lester tweets criticizing his moderating the debate. And there are a number of examples of John Lester tweeting out, "Hey, bud, you got the wrong Lester here."
I think so.
Or "I'm sure Lester Holt would appreciate that. You should tweet at him." Now, fortunately, I don't see what those original tweets were, but I can only imagine what it was like, particularly since they were in response to people who used a handle that started with the word deplorable, which suggests that they were Donald Trump supporters. But all in all, interesting times that we live in as we're in the last full month of the campaign leading up to Election Day. At least we've got the Cubs to kind of take our mind off things. We've got the Hawks going. And I am wearing a Chicago Bears jersey today. Of course, it's a Matt Forte jersey, but nevertheless, you know, if there's going to be a game to win this season, I got to think this should be it.
You did say four wins before the year, and I laughed at you.
You laughed, and now I'm thinking I might have been too optimistic. But Jay Cutler not starting again?
Don't believe so. I don't think he's been ruled out yet, but that's how John Fox plays it. He's like, yeah, maybe he'll play, maybe not.
Yeah. Well, that's part of that confidence building that the Bears are doing so well this year at. So, but, yeah, Bears taking on Detroit at home. And was it 20? You mentioned something about that it's been a long time since the Bears won a home game.
I saw something. It's been a while, maybe a year or so, you know, since last season. Sam, what do you have a statistic there as to when they won?
They're 1-9 at home under John Fox.
Yeah.
And as I pull up the schedule, it was last season, 2015. I think their last win was, I want to say, October of 2015.
Yep, that's what I saw. That's about what I saw. Okay. Yes, yes.
So we'll all be keeping an eye down on all the action at Soldier Field. Although I don't think you have to be too intense about watching all of that. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam's...
Have a wonderful show, Nick.
Thank you, Mr. Schwan.
We'll be listening.
Thank you very much. That's, of course, the great Dave Schwan. Sam's got all the latest sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. That's our text line as well, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. On Twitter, @SymbolSundaySpin. Engineer Bob is changing the oil on the newsroom Zamboni to get ready for the fall season ahead. And remember, you can always find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. We've got a great show ahead today. After the 7:30 news update, we'll speak to my Tribune colleague Bill Ruthart, who covers the mayor and city hall, and we'll be talking about whether a school strike is just around the corner. After the top of the hour, we'll have a news update from Dave, and then we'll talk to Rob Carr. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, and he'll be here to talk about the effort to band small business people together over a host of new city ordinances and regulations. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by my good friend Chris Mooney. Chris is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we'll talk to Chris about last week's debate, Tuesday's vice presidential debate, and whether in this unusual year, whether debates really matter. That's all ahead. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning, everyone. Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue in Tribune Tower. And it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And we've got all kinds of news that kind of has broken over the weekend. We have the fact that the New York Times actually did a review of Donald Trump's 1995 income tax returns, in which, of course, we know the issue that Trump has not released his current tax returns. But in these 1995 income tax returns, he declared a $916 million loss. And as a result of that loss, it could have allowed him to legally avoid paying any federal income taxes for up to 18 years in the future. And that's based on documents obtained by the New York Times. Now, Trump himself has been tweeting. He's not denying any of this, and you know how prolific he is on Twitter, but he's typing out things like on Twitter from Donald Trump, "I know our complex tax laws better than anyone who has ever run for president, and am the only one who can fix them." And then he uses hashtag failing New York Times. So that's Donald Trump and the taxes, and that story is going to remain hot. We also have the story of a hacked audio conversation between Hillary Clinton and donors during a February fundraising event in which she describes the supporters of Bernie Sanders, her then rival for the Democratic nomination. She described them as children of the Great Recession who are living in their parents' basement. Now, she did go on to say, that there's a feeling that they've got their education and the jobs that are available to them are not at all what they envision for themselves. They don't see much of a future. If you're feeling like you're consigned to being a barista or, you know, some other job that doesn't pay a lot and doesn't have some other ladder of opportunity attached to it, then the idea that maybe, just maybe, you could be part of a political revolution is pretty appealing. I think we should all be really understanding of that, is what Clinton said. Well, we've got all that, and of course, the first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton still dominating the news. Clinton was almost universally acclaimed the winner. Donald Trump claims he's the winner. Trump did have what I thought was one very strong moment, and it came early in the debate when he talked about Clinton's record and the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA.
So I know how to really work to get new jobs and to get exports that help to create more new jobs.
Eric, well, you haven't done it in 30 years or 26 years.
Well, I've been a senator.
You haven't done it.
And I have been a Secretary of State, and I have
done it. Your husband signed NAFTA, which was one of the worst things that ever happened to the manufacturing industry.
That is your opinion.
You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing is down 30, 40, sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And now you want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate. But you know that if you did win, you would approve that, and that will be almost as bad as NAFTA. Nothing will ever top NAFTA.
Well, we'll continue our spin through the national politics throughout the morning. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Introducing Fox Hunting on the radio.
John Fox, he has this dumb look on his face all the time, and he's staring up to the big jumbotron. How can that inspire you if you're a player?
Your head coach is the guy that is always thinking not only a play ahead, but maybe a series. And you look at this guy looking up at the screen, he's contemplating anything other than what's on the bus in the box that we get to eat on the way to the airport.
The Bears Conversation.
How much longer is this game going?
Chevy Pampano Beach Show with Cos.
We'd love to say something nice. We don't run well. We don't pass well. The play calling is just god-awful. Boy, this has got to stop.
Sunday, right after Bears-Lions on 720 WGN. Sponsored by your local Chevy dealer and ChevyDriveChicago.com.
I can't get the alarm company on the phone to save my life. My alarm's going off all the time, and I don't know why. It's driving me crazy.
Call Alarm Detection Systems. We have live reps answering our phones 24/7, 365. No auto attendant. Call 630-844-6300. Get better customer service in return. Alarm Detection Systems is an authorized Honeywell equipment dealer. Visit adsalarm.com. Alarm license number 127-000-143.
I'm living alone for the first time in 40 years, and I'm worried something might happen to me.
Live independently with a medical alert device from Alarm Detection Systems. Setup is easy, and 24/7 emergency assistance monitoring is included. Alarm Detection Systems is an authorized Honeywell equipment dealer. Visit adsalarm.com or call 630-844-6300. Alarm license number 127-000-143.
Blackhawk fans, got a question for me, Troy Murray? Email it to asktroy@wgnradio.com. If your question is used on air, you'll win a Pequod's Pizza, sponsored by Chicago's own Nuveen.
Non-attorney paid spokesperson, paid by Open Jar.
Attention, if you or a loved one took blood thinner medications and experienced a serious bleeding event, you may be entitled to cash compensation. Call 800-241-3144 now. Popular blood thinner medications such as Xarelto or Prodentis have been linked to an increased risk of severe internal bleeding, hemorrhaging, stroke, heart attack, and even death. If you or a loved one has experienced a serious bleeding event or died from serious internal bleeding after taking any blood thinner medication, including Xarelto or Pradaxa, you may be entitled to substantial compensation. Call Blood Thinner Helpline now at 800-241-3144. Our network of experienced attorneys are ready to help fight for you. You won't pay a thing until your case is settled. Call 800-241-3144. Don't delay, because the window to
to file a claim is limited. If you or a loved one has been hospitalized or died after taking any blood thinner medications, including Xarelto or Pradaxa, you may be entitled to substantial cash compensation. Call 800-241-3144. 800-241-3144.
Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be talking to my good friend Bill Ruthart, who covers City Hall and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, about some of the recent events going on surrounding the mayor, the city, and whether we are going to face a Chicago Public School strike. That's all up ahead on the Sunday Spin.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin for the first Sunday in October of 2016. We've been talking a little bit about the debate last Monday, and yes, it's still dominating the news. And, you know, I played that cut of Trump going after Clinton pretty strong on NAFTA. But then, of course, you know, for every strong point, there tends to be a weakness. And Clinton had a strong point in the debate when he went after Trump over referring to former Miss Universe Alicia Machado as Miss Piggy and Miss Housekeeper. Well, it got under Trump's skin. And of course, the next day on Fox and Friends, Trump decided to double down.
I know that person. That person was a Miss Universe person. Mm-hmm. And she was the worst we ever had. The worst, the absolute worst. She was impossible. And she was a Miss Universe contestant and ultimately a winner who they had a tremendously difficult time with as Miss Universe.
Did not know that story.
Well, I didn't know it either.
What?
She was the winner, and, you know, she gained a massive amount of weight, and it was a real problem. We had a real problem. Not only that, her attitude, and we had a real problem with her. So Hillary went back into the years, and she found this girl. This was many years ago. And found the girl and talked about her like she was Mother Teresa.
Now, Trump didn't let it end there. He was even sending out a series of tweets criticizing Clinton and Machado at 3 a.m. in the morning, including mentioning a, quote, Machado sex tape, which didn't really exist. And then it's, of course, comes out that Trump played a rather benign role in a soft porn video that Playboy put out. But perhaps some of the real damage was in Trump repeatedly saying throughout the debate that he never said some things that he had clearly said in the past. And that was the subject of a new Clinton ad.
You even at one time suggested that you would try to negotiate down the national debt of the United States.
I would borrow, knowing that if the economy crashed, you could make a deal.
I was against the war in Iraq, just so you put it out.
The record shows otherwise.
The record does not show that.
Why was your judgment?
The record shows that I'm right.
Are you for invading Iraq?
Yeah, I guess so.
He even said, well, you know, if there were nuclear war in the East Asia, well, you know, that's fine. You know, have a good time, folks. And in fact,
good luck, folks. Enjoy yourself.
Someone who has said pregnancy is an inconvenience to employers, who has said women...
Pregnancy is never... it's a wonderful thing for the woman. It's a wonderful thing for the husband. It's certainly an inconvenience for a business.
Who has said women don't deserve equal pay unless they do as good a job as men.
If you become president, will a woman make the same as a man?
You're going to make the same if you do as good a job.
You admitted that you hadn't paid federal taxes and that that was smart. Is that what you meant to say?
No, I didn't say that at all.
He didn't pay any federal income tax.
That makes
if
me smart.
And there you go. That was the latest Clinton ad to point out some of the apparent inconsistencies in Donald Trump's statements during the debate. Well, joining me now on this segment of the Sunday Spin is my good friend Bill Ruthart, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, and covers City Hall, and Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And Bill, thank you, as always, for getting up this morning.
It's always an honor to join the morning swim, Rick.
Okay, and that's a good thing that Panayotovich is not listening. Otherwise, he'd punch the water sound.
I will say I have a bit of a cold this morning, so if you hear any Trump-like sniffles, I apologize to the listeners, but I will not blame WGN's microphones for my condition.
Are you allergic to cats?
I actually am allergic to cats.
Okay, then that might explain another reason, but we won't go into that right now. But thanks again for joining me. You know, this has been just nonstop crazy times over at City Hall. And, you see now that the teachers have, you know, authorized a possible strike just days away. And it's still my belief that the teachers believe Rahm Emanuel is as politically weak as they've ever seen. But how, in your view, you know, how likely is it that we're going to see a strike, or are there ways to kind of make up some of the budget issues that exist?
Yeah, I mean, he can be as weak as they want him to be, but if there's no money, there's no money. And I think that's a bit of the realization that the teachers union is coming to here. Is that,
well, it didn't, and frankly, when that first kind of framework was agreed upon, that was then rejected by the larger group of delegates for the CTU. But wasn't, at that point, that was kind of an acknowledgement, yeah, there are real money problems.
Right. Let's go back just to frame this up for folks. I mean, you had the 2012 teacher strike where a lot of the issues that they went on strike there weren't so much financial. It was the mayor wanted a longer school day. He wanted stronger teacher evaluations. He wanted reforms on testing. He wanted merit pay, all these things. And so they went on strike then. The deal they got after that seven-day strike went through the end of June 2015. And so after right after June of 2015, Forrest Claypool comes in to start running Chicago Public Schools for the mayor. He immediately rescinds a one-year extension offer that was on the table. And the city started pushing hard for the union to pay for what's called the so-called pension pickup, which teachers are required to pay 9% toward their pensions. And
9% of their salary towards their pension.
And historically, CPS has covered 7% of that pension pickup for them. But with the Chicago Public Schools finances, you know, at some points the deficits reached over $1 billion. Part of the negotiations with Claypool is he wanted the teachers to start paying for that portion of the pension contribution. So in January, there was a tentative deal between CPS and the union. It would have barred any economic layoffs until 2019. It was a four-year deal. Would have frozen the number of charter schools at the 130 that exist today. There would have been some moderate pay raises. In exchange, the city would have gotten the higher retirement contributions from the teachers, and they would have had to pay some more toward their health benefits. Karen Lewis strikes this deal with the city, takes it to a 40-member bargaining team. They call it the big bargaining team. And that team rejected the offer, so they didn't take it to the full membership for the vote. And Lewis said that, well, it's trust issues with CPS is the reason. So there's a lot of speculation. Well, did she really want that deal and she couldn't sell it to her bargaining team? Or was that a kind of a charade that was going on? And I think there's varying opinions on that.
Although it does, let's face it, you know, when you think you are bargaining in good faith with any party and it ultimately gets rejected, it raises questions about how do you bargain in the future.
Right. And you have a union membership at CTU that has been, you know, for years. I mean, they're literally the organization that's nicknamed Rahm Emanuel Mayor 1%,
right?
For taking all these contributions from millionaires. They've picketed at banks. They've called for a LaSalle Street tax on financial transactions. They called for a graduated state income tax, taxing the wealthy more. Of course, all these ideas sound great, but politically, basically impossible. They require action in Springfield. We got a Republican governor who would veto that kind of thing. The transaction tax could run afoul of federal law. So those possibilities that they've thrown out there really haven't been that realistic. And they're coming to the realization here that there's just not going to be a ton of money to be had out there, and they're going to have to start paying some more toward their retirement.
So, and in the meantime, along with the retirement and the pension pickup, there's also the issue of there's, quote, money on the table in Springfield, but that's contingent upon a larger comprehensive deal involving public employee pensions that, regardless of whether you think it's constitutional or not, is going to be caught up in the courts for years anyway. And that's $250 million sitting there. And I mean, so where does the money come from?
Well, there's a discussion here now on this contract as to, you know, we mentioned these other possibilities that aren't that realistic. One that is are these tax increment finance districts that the city has. And, I don't know if you need to go to break soon, because it might take me a minute to go through what tax increment finance districts are.
Okay, you know what? Yes. But I think actually, but I want you to do that because, you know, people hear about, oh, there's TIF money buried here and there's TIF money there and all that. And I don't think they understand really how TIFs work. So that's very helpful. But
there's a teaser for you. Stay tuned for TIFs.
A TIF tease, as it were. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm speaking with my Tribune colleague, Bill Ruthart, who covers City Hall, as well as Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And we're going to get the abbreviated version of what are these TIF districts? How do they work? And why is there money that we could tap for schools
there? Right. So tax increment finance districts are these districts that were originally created in state law to allow the city to collect taxes from what are supposed to be blighted areas so that the taxes that the city brings in are frozen. Anything above that frozen limit.
Incremental.
As development happens in a blighted area, they get to take that money and they turn around and invest it back in the area in projects, whether it's roads, infrastructure, or help subsidize projects like the Whole Foods in Inglewood that just opened last week. So there's 146 of these districts in the city. Many of them under Daley, they're downtown. They're not necessarily blighted areas. They're all over the city. And so these bring in money every year, and there's a lot of money beyond what is spent on what is tapped for projects, and that's referred to as surplus. So each of these 146 districts have a surplus of money sitting in them that doesn't already go to projects that are...
It's not dedicated.
It's not dedicated. Earmarked. Right. And so the mayor's already taken some heat on this, and he's got a policy where 25% of those surpluses every year get swept up and redistributed back to CPS, the city, the county, et cetera. So there is more than that 25% that he spreads back around. And so the teachers union has been calling for him to sweep up all of those surpluses and dedicate a lot of it to CPS, including the city's share of the surpluses. And so there is a pot of money there. Last year, the surpluses were about $113 million, I think. So, you know, half of that went to CPS, but there could be more this year. CPS could get the city's share if the mayor decided to do that. So there's some money there that could be used to ensure there aren't further layoffs, could increase the size of a potential raise for teachers. The mayor's been going around talking about, well, we have an offer on the table that gives teachers a 13% raise, which to the average person is like, man, why didn't they take the deal, right? But that doesn't take into effect this pension pickup we've talked about, where they have to pay an extra 7% toward the retirements and the extra health care costs. So really the offer on the table right now is a pretty modest raise, and we don't know exactly because it depends on your level of experience and where you are in your career. But so this TIF money could be used to either bump up the pay raise for teachers or get, you know, provide better job security, that kind of thing. So there's some talk centered on those TIF districts right now.
We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome as always to the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. You know, actually, I'm against the TIF money being used. You know, one of the problems we run into government when you start taking money and moving it around away from the designated purpose. So I'm totally against that. But here's a bigger issue. I wanted to ask you a real question. It recently showed that there was a decline in enrollment in public school. How is that going to affect the bargaining leverage of these the teachers union? They're losing students, and that results in less money. So just want to ask you, would that have some kind of effect on the bargaining power? Thank you,
Ron.
Well, it's certainly a factor. I mean, we've seen some teacher layoffs, a lot of them for that very reason, and schools where enrollment is down. They've redone the budgeting where the budget dollars flow to schools based on enrollment. There's been some changes. You have this kind of dichotomy in Chicago. You have these schools that are 40% full or even less. And then you have schools on the northwest and southwest sides that are crazily overcrowded, and they're trying to build on annexes and whatnot. So it is a factor.
And then you have the touchy political issue of school closures and impact in neighborhoods.
And let's remember in 2013, the mayor closed nearly 50 neighborhood schools. There was a 5-year moratorium on that. So he can't close anymore until 2018. That's also why you've seen the teachers union seek a freeze on charter schools in this contract, because they don't want to see, you know, more public school students potentially leaving those schools and going to additional charter schools, which worsens the problem. The caller was just there talking about them, you know, in terms of less enrollment.
And with all of this, too, is, you know, when the teachers went out the first time in the mayor's first term, the timing was different. And now here we are, you know, smack right into the school year. We've had in our Tribune polls have shown overwhelming support among the public on who do you side with, mm-hmm. ROM or CP or CTU, when it comes to improving schools. But I just wonder if the climate may have changed somewhat this time around. And we that's something we can only speculate.
It's changed in two directions. I mean, in one sense, the mayor is a heck of a lot less popular now than he was in 2013. Right. So that cuts against him. On the other side of it, there's an inconvenience factor. That's why the mayor's been talking about it. You know, what do you do with your children? You know, it's bad enough when your kid's sick and you have to stay home from work. What if it's a, you know, indefinite teacher strike, right? So he's bringing up some of these things. But I think it's important to note that the tone is a lot more civil than it was in 2013. Yes. You had the mayor saying that the union was out for themselves, that kids were getting the shaft. There was the infamous exchange with Karen Lewis in which he said F you, Lewis, to her in a heated meeting at City Hall. Back then, Karen Lewis was calling Rahm Emanuel the murder mayor and a bully. And just to show the change in tone, just last week, Lewis was at an event at the Hideout, and they were talking politics. And she said, you know, Rahm Emanuel's not stupid. We're not rude to each other anymore. That didn't work. There was a definite change in the relationship. I think, you know, she was gearing up to run against him for mayor, and then right. she came down with that cancer diagnosis of brain cancer. And I think they've been a lot more civil to each other since. But their relationship and them cutting the deal, or the CPS bargaining team versus the CTU bargaining team, that's one thing. Her turning around and then selling that to her membership is another. And so that's going to be a key to keep our eye on as this moves forward. But right now, the strike date's October 11th. So there's, you know, the clock is ticking, I guess.
Very much so. Very quickly, I want to talk to you about another issue that I know you're really familiar with, and that's the whole idea of food deserts. And, of course, all the hoopla about the opening, the formal opening of the Whole Foods in Inglewood. And that is just, I mean... And then what I really like is that then the mayor was complaining about the price of a smoothie over there.
He was. I think the smoothie was like $5 and $5.62 or something. So he wasn't too happy about that. He was giving the Whole Foods CEO a hard time. But yeah, that opened in Inglewood this week, which for those of you that aren't that familiar with Chicago's neighborhoods, which I don't think it's too many of your listeners, but it's a neighborhood on the south side. It's had a lot of economic challenges, a lot of crime. The mayor 3 years ago cut a deal with Whole Foods to build a store there. It's been not a week has gone by in those 3 years probably where Rahm Emanuel hasn't talked about this Correct. Whole Foods and what he's doing to invest in these neighborhoods and in particular cut down on these food deserts, which when he ran for mayor, he said there's about 600,000 people who lived in food deserts in Chicago, almost 20% of the city's population. I won't bore you with all the details, but when he got in the office, he started measuring these food deserts differently, and the 600,000 turned into only about 100,000 people that he thought really lived in food deserts. And under that new measurement, he's cut the food deserts by about 20%, which is less than the half he had hoped to by now, and he still has a goal to get rid of them by 2020. But this Whole Foods, the interesting part about it, while it's a great asset for that neighborhood and certainly an option that they don't have now, it isn't actually in a food desert because there's an Aldi a couple blocks away. So it's just one of those things where, you know, you have politicians going around for, in this case, 3 years with the mayor talking about food deserts and using this Whole Foods as an example. And really, it didn't cut down on a food desert at all. And he definitely has some work to do on the issue. But it'll be very interesting to see how the Whole Foods fares there. I know that a lot of investment was made, $10 million on the city's behalf on a whole shopping center there. And certainly folks are hoping it's successful. So perhaps they can see similar developments in other areas of the city that truly are food deserts that really do need the access to fresh fruits and vegetables and fresh meat.
And sure, and looking for that is kind of spurring that investment that everybody talks about but never mm-hmm. happens in these impoverished communities. But at the same time, and so there's also a Starbucks next to it.
That's
too.
Right. Yeah.
And, but, you know, when you look at a Whole Foods or frankly, even a Starbucks, they're kind of boutique places.
I mean, Whole Foods is known as Whole Paycheck for its reputation for having very pricey, organic products. You know, I know that they've made some adjustments to their business plan in Inglewood to try to make things more affordable. There are just some products, you know, in talking to some of the vendors, they're going to have their products on the shelf there. There's a push to have local folks have their products on the shelf. And some of those folks are talking about how, you know, Whole Foods is, on some things like a bag of flour, they're going to try to match, you know, some of the lower discount options in the area. Some of the staples. But, you know, the chicken from the high-end organic farm is still the chicken from the high-end organic farm, and it still has a certain cost to provide. And so I think there's less flexibility for them on those products. So I'm no grocery price expert, but it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
But you are a foodie. I know that much.
As long as it's not fruits and vegetables either. I'm probably not the best poster child for that. So,
Bill Ruthart, my Tribune colleague who covers City Hall, and Mayor Rahm Emanuel, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning.
Good to be on, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to the second hour of your Sunday Spin for the first Sunday in October 2016. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And we've been kind of going through some of the great debate kind of news. And Hillary Clinton was able to use the debate for a number of ads. We played one before. She also played an ad noting how Trump talked kind of expressively about the fact that he thinks he has the better temperament to lead the country.
She doesn't have the look. She doesn't have the stamina. I have much better judgment than she does. There's no question about that. I also have a much better temperament than she has. My strongest asset, maybe by far, is my temperament. I have a winning temperament.
Woo! Okay.
And so you have that. But Trump also was up with new ads this week, including one that took on Clinton's much earlier remark that she believed that half of Trump's supporters were a basket of deplorables.
Why aren't I 50 points ahead, you might ask?
Maybe it's because the director of the FBI said you lied about your emails.
There was classified material emails.
Or maybe it's because your policies have allowed ISIS and terrorism to spread. Or maybe it's because you call Americans deplorable.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Why aren't I 50 points ahead, you might ask?
Do you really need to ask?
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
So that's Donald Trump's latest ad as well. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Rob Carr. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Rob, thank you so much for joining me.
Good morning, Rick. Good to be with you in studio.
Yes, and now you get to see the lavish digs here of the Allstate Showcase studio.
World headquarters, very impressive. I like the view.
Very nice, and yes, it's a great view out on Michigan Avenue. Yeah. And, of course, next week we'll have all of the marathoners going by, and Bob will be keeping count of who's ahead as they get past this check mark. And you're lucky that you came in this week, because when they put up all of the barriers,
couldn't get here.
You were not going to be able to get here. Trust me. Well, I wanted to have you on because I know you've been speaking out about this idea of trying to unite small business people here in the city of Chicago to really kind of take a look at the things that they're facing when it comes to new ordinances, new taxes, and new regulations. And I guess my question is, how come these people didn't get organized before?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at small businesses, small employers, they're entrepreneurial, right? They're focused on their business. They're starting up. They have a lot of capital at risk. They're very focused on what they're
doing.
It's
not about being joiners.
It's not about being joiners. And it's a little different, frankly, and you and I are old enough now to talk about our generations, right? So it's different from our parents' generation, or our even our generation to a certain extent. They were more joiners. They joined whatever was the JCs, like my parents were involved, or the Rotary or things like that. Even those organizations are struggling to get the new generation involved. They're very focused on what they're doing, and when they're not, they want to be focused on their family or their particular interests. And government doesn't always come naturally to people. You know, I was reading an article about someone who represents tech companies nationwide and talked about the fact that they just don't get it, and it's hard for them to understand it. They're used to solving problems.
They're playing defense.
They're playing defense, and getting them to understand that government impacts the way you do business, and government can shut you down. I'll never forget Walmart. You know, I know Walmart's not a small business, although they started out that way. But back in the early 2000s, Walmart never had a government affairs operation, ever. Then California did their big box law, and it suddenly woke them up to the fact that government can not only impact the way you do business, government can shut you down. And the same is true for small business. And I think you just have to translate that to them, educate them on that, and then give them an easy means of making their voice heard. And that's what we're hoping to do.
Part of it is it also too part of this kind of transitionary period that we're in, where, you know, between brick and mortar and internet as well, because given that you have a lot of, as you mentioned, tech, you have all of these kind of startups,
yep,
but they're also part of the retail cog of the machine as well.
Oh, they most certainly are, and we take them all into consideration. But when you're a brick and mortar, that presents another challenge, correct? Because,
well, yes, indeed.
And I don't want to get ahead, but the mandates that come from government most often apply to brick and mortar because they can't apply to the internet sellers. So that presents another rub and another challenge for brick and mortar. And so we're just trying to get them involved and get them focused on expressing to policymakers exactly how all of these proposals impact them.
Well, let's take a look at some of the things.
Sure.
And frankly, off the air, I said to Rob, I said this kind of dovetails to a bit of our discussion a couple of weeks ago with Sam Toya from the Illinois Restaurant Association about what small business owners and entrepreneurs, restaurant owners, entrepreneurs as well, what they face when it comes to doing business in the city of Chicago. And these hurdles, I mean, it's kind of a compilation of things. You've got minimum wage, property taxes, water sewer fees. Mm-hmm. I know you guys were very concerned about the plastic bags,
man. Yeah.
There's, you know, still talk about things like, you know, soda tax,
right,
things. I mean, these things just keep piling up.
They do. And as you and I were just briefly discussing off air, policymakers tend to look at these things in silos. And what we've been trying to educate not only policymakers but opinion makers on is businesses don't look at these things in silos. They don't say, oh, okay, plastic bags, I can absorb that. PTO, oh, okay, paid time off, sorry, I can absorb that. Minimum wage, oh, okay, I can absorb that because it only adds X cost, each of those. Employers look at it and say, wait a minute, I've got one pocket. It's coming out of, all those expenses are coming out of one pocket. I look at it in the aggregate. And so we're trying to get policymakers and opinion makers to understand that's the cumulative impact matters. And the cumulative impact not only of what the city does, but what the county does, particularly Cook County, and frankly, what the state does. It impacts all business the same way. They don't look at it separately, and that's important.
And when you look at the city and you see it almost becoming this island in its taxation, you wonder, why would you want to start a business in the city? Obviously, you've got population, but your margins, especially starting out, you know, your margins aren't going to be great.
It is a mantra we hear all the time. They have limited, you know, it's another thing, for employers have limited amounts of capital to invest, either initially or every year, whether you're a small operation or a large operation. You have a limited amount of capital to invest. You're going to invest that where you can get your best return on investment. Might you open a store or two in Cook County or the city? Yeah, you might. But you're probably going to, instead of opening 10, you're going to open 2, right? They make that decision because they can put the other 8 somewhere where the return on investment is much greater. And unfortunately, for all of the factors that are impacting employers in the city, the county, and the state, those decisions are being made exactly along that lines, opening 1 instead of 10.
So with the small businesses, and you mentioned that, you know, these are newer entrepreneurs and they're not necessarily the joiners, but are they too the ones that are looking at things in this kind of siloed way rather than in the comprehensive way?
I don't think it's fair to say they're looking at it as silo. I think, again, they have a lot on the line, right? Most entrepreneurs have put everything they own, everything they have,
and are leveraged
to the hilt. Many times they're putting it on their own credit cards because, for better or worse, federal banking reforms have made access to capital harder for smaller entrepreneurs. So they're leveraged. They're very focused on survival, and they need to get through that first 3 to 5 years to become viable. So it's hard. It's impossible to be critical, frankly, of them. I think we just have to help them understand, as we started out, just the impact government have and how it can eat away at their ability to make it to that key 3 to 5 years.
We're speaking with Rob Carr. He's the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We're talking about the formation of this Neighborhood Small Business Committee. And I guess really my next question is, once you got a committee, what are you going to do with it?
Sure, that's a great question. So Illinois Retail Merchants and Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce teamed up, as we do on other things, and created this small business committee. It'll have 12 individuals on it. We will interview them. We will interview others. We will have, we're still working with the chairman, but I'm sure we'll have meetings in different parts of the city and the county with various employers and get their impact, kind of pick their brains on the challenges they're facing. I'm sure early on it'll be heavy in kind of the licensing, permitting, regulatory type.
The red tape.
The red tape. We've already heard some real interesting stories. You know, you have a restaurant has three locations. They're not inexperienced. Took them 2 years to open their new restaurant. No good reason.
They're a chain. They know how to do it.
So what does someone who's just starting out do, right? It probably takes them longer. One of the co-chairmen, Neil Byers, who owns a microbrewery, put a modest expansion in. It was signed off by city inspectors. And less than a year later, another city and plumbing inspector came in, made him put in several thousand dollars of additional changes. Nothing had changed. It's just a difference of opinion. There shouldn't be that inconsistency, right? We get it if there's a regulatory change, but if there's no regulatory change and city inspectors just signed off on the plan, why is he having to go back and do this again? It was completely subjective. And I think we'll have to look at rulemaking. As you know from your days in Springfield has a good rulemaking process when it comes to bureaucracies, right? There's an accountability measure to it. Now, there's some challenges here in the city. And I'm talking about the joint committee process in Springfield. There's some challenges here in the city because you don't have, quote unquote, the loyal opposition.
Correct.
Right? But certainly there needs to be a system where you have transparency, where people have some notice that rules are coming up and have some opinion, some chance to opine on them and require some feedback from the bureaucracy to either defend that or to rethink what they're proposing. That doesn't exist in the city today. A department can put out a reg, and the next day it can happen.
Well, and or somebody then tries to go to Springfield to prohibit the city's ability to enforce that kind of a rule.
Absolutely.
I mean, which is kind of a backward way of doing things,
right,
as well.
Right, another fist fight, right?
Don't we have plenty of
those? We have plenty of those.
Speaking of fist fights, let's talk about Springfield.
Okay.
when we've had people from the business community on, and I know this may sound like a broken record, but it's the idea everybody wants to, they may not agree with certain laws, with regulations, with whatever, but everybody agrees certainty is kind of that basic bedrock that businesses want. And when you look at everything that's gone involving Springfield in the last 2 years, certainty is the last thing anybody can say that we have in this state. And now we have the election going forward, and maybe some seats will change. I don't know that a great number will, but who knows? We'll see, because there's an awful lot of money being poured into these legislative contests, more than I ever imagined that I would ever see in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. That having been said, I don't know at the end of the day, on November 9th, that the climate is necessarily going to change that's going to resolve anything in Springfield.
The only thing that is certain right now is uncertainty when it comes to Springfield. And it does erode confidence, again, when you're looking at investing in Illinois. Illinois has a great many things going for it. Our location is tremendous. Our transportation system is very good. So we have a generally educated workforce. We have excellent higher learning institutions. So we have a lot going for us, but that uncertainty does plague us.
Well, but for all those great things, yep, though, all of those things seem to have eroded in the last 2 years.
They are certainly eroding. You're absolutely right. I mean,
our infrastructure, our higher education, right. We've talked about the uncertainty in that and the number of kids that
are making choices to go elsewhere. Absolutely.
And they're not going to come back necessarily.
And frankly, higher education institutions are having a harder time attracting talent to be professors because they're looking and wondering about the certainty. So there's all of that. We do need to correct that. I don't think anybody is everybody is wrong and everybody is right in this argument is
correct.
The problem, right? There's just a lack of trust.
But that's the politics
right.
and that we live in today, and it's that Washington style of politics that I always hated and said, well, I'm going back to Springfield, where there was still a modicum of statesmanship that used to exist. And now we're just seeing that that politics is, it's the same Washington style. It's the winner take all. And one side is right, the other side is wrong. And there's no gradation.
No in between.
And we all know life isn't that simple. And it was never that simple in Springfield.
It was never that simple. And the middle that we used to so rely upon in Springfield in my early days, I've been at it 24 years. I think you're just a little longer, Rick, but maybe not.
Boy, he keeps going after the age thing. He's as bad as Schwani, you know?
but that middle has eroded. But I do, we talked to rank and file legislators a lot. There is a desire by everyone that I've met to have some middle ground. I think the question is how to get there. And again, the trust factor is missing. And as you know, in all of this, trust is very important.
Sure, it's the biggest currency. Your word is your bond. And whether you disagree with somebody or not, it's a heck of a lot easier to know that a no is a no or a yes is a yes or I'll take a look at it as, a consideration.
From a group that represents employers, and we're only one. I mean, you have others like the Manufacturers Association, the Chicagoland Chamber, but I think we've all talked and we're all kind of in the same boat in terms of representing our members. No one likes taxes, higher taxes, no one. I think everyone recognizes that they're inevitable given the situation of the state and the city, because let's not forget the city in this discussion.
Correct.
Right? And to an even lesser extent, the county. And those need to be addressed, but you can't have it all. That's where I think from an employer's perspective, the policymakers need to rethink a little bit here. If you want to solve all those problems, and we think you need to solve those problems and return stability and certainty, then you can't be piling on other things, whether that other thing is jacking the minimum wage up to $13 or $15 or paid time off or regulating scheduling or substantial environmental regulations. You can't do all of those and expect employers because, let's face it, policymakers always look to employers to carry the lion's share of whatever it is. Right. And we also have to take a long view. You can't just hold that off for a year or two. It took a couple decades to get in this mess. It's probably going to take a couple decades to get out of this mess. And we have to have some restraint.
At least a couple of decades.
But
it's a two-way street.
It is a two-way street.
And you can't just do taxes, but it's got to be part of a comprehensive package. But you can't get even to that talking point if everybody's talking past each other because they don't trust each other.
And I think the environment has become so toxic that those who might be willing to are a little leery of sticking their head up to try to bring the sides together as well.
Because of the certain enforcement, for fear of losing your head. Yes, the certain enforcement mechanisms that exist in Illinois and Springfield politics.
Yeah.
Rob Carr, President and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Let us know how rounding up the Small Business Council works.
Thanks again. It's a pleasure to see you, be in the studio with you, and we'll keep you in the loop.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with my good friend Chris Mooney. Chris is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and we'll take a look back at last week's debate, what's ahead on Tuesday in the vice presidential debate, and really the fundamental question, do debates really matter?
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. On a personal note, I want to thank everybody that took part in the fundraiser for Eileen Taylor and Baton Rouge flood relief efforts. And we had a great turnout at our fundraiser and some really great silent auction offers. But you can still contribute if you'd like. There's a GoFundMe page. GoFundMe.com/Eileen Taylor is the URL for that. But thank you all for your thoughts and consideration, and it's very much appreciated. Well, last night was the season opener of Saturday Night Live, and SNL's never short in taking on the politics of the day. And so their cold opener of the show featured Alec Baldwin, now playing Donald Trump, and Kate McKinnon with her Hillary Clinton caricature. And they featured their take on the great debate, including Donald Trump's reference to Chicago.
The thing about the blacks is that they're killing each other. Blacks live on one street in Chicago, all on one street. I just read that this morning. It's called Hell Street. And they're on Hell Street, and they're all just killing each other, just like I am killing this debate.
Secretary Clinton, did you have a response?
Not a response, more of a request. Can America vote right now?
That's the cold opener from last night's Saturday Night Live. Also, they featured a Family Feud political edition of Team Clinton versus Team Trump, and a pretty good kickoff of the show. Well, joining me now on the Sunday Spin is my good friend Chris Mooney. Chris is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois and a great observer of the political scene. Chris, thanks for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for making me laugh first thing in the morning again.
Well,
we need a little more laughter this year, I think.
Well, you know, and it's kind of interesting, too, because the Tribune had a story about is it okay to still make fun of Donald Trump because of the serious issues that are involved in his candidacy?
Well, you know, we've been making fun of politicians in this country since George Washington and when they were, you know, so maybe they didn't make fun of George Washington. I don't know. He didn't.
Oh, nobody made fun of George Washington. Come on.
But they certainly made fun of, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, and God knows Abraham Lincoln was the butt of many a joke. So, you know, if you can, that's part of the democracy, the bringing them down to the level of the common people, right? You get a laugh at them. And also it helps us through these tough times. I mean, you know, my feeling is, right, this year, if you don't laugh a little, you're going to cry. So, and I've already done enough crying, so. A little laughter is good. But I will say, I mean, that was pretty good shtick last night. Alec Baldwin was funny. Trump is a tough one to do because he's so funny just in and of himself. It's hard to, how do you parody the guy? For my money, the they've done a lot of political satire over the years on Saturday Night Live, but nothing compares with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey doing Hillary and Sarah Palin back in Hawaii. That was astonishingly funny.
And yes, parody is a great thing, but in some respects, and part of the thing that was raised in the story was that every time that Trump is kind of made fun of or because of something he says or whatever, he actually gets stronger to some degree. You know, and let's face it, look at all of these things that he said throughout the campaign that would have been the death knell for any other candidate.
Yeah, that's true. But everybody has to take this from. It's such an unprecedented year. We don't know what to. I mean, I don't know what to think. My wife, she was very upset when he came out and announced that he was going to run back in June of 15 or whatever it was, and. He came down the golden escalator and said some comments about the Latinos that she took offense to. And I said, don't worry. This is just a promotion for his next reality show. It's just a way to pump up, the brand so he can, move himself up to 10 billion instead of 7. So I've lost all credibility with Laura. I was going to go on more in a couple of months, but the guy does have a serious chance of winning. There's no doubt about that. So, I mean, in that sense, we have to take it seriously, either pro or con. And, I remain to some degree agnostic on this. I have my own point of view, but I think democracy is about, people taking a look at the different options and making a choice as opposed to come up with some ideal candidate in their own mind. and it's serious business.
Well, but what does it say that Trump, you know, has this strength? And what does it say about some of those Republicans who were adamantly against a Donald Trump nomination have now seemed to fallen in line? And among those, you know, Joe Ricketts, and they were very active. The Republican Ricketts were very active in super PAC opposition to Trump, and now you have Joe Ricketts throwing in $1 million into a pro-Trump super PAC.
Yeah, and you know, and you have Ted Cruz. I mean, he's right. The most obvious example, right? You know, Trump goes on TV and slanders his wife and slanders his father, and he crawls back to him when he sees the polls are moving up in the right direction. But you know, and I think that demonstrates a certain opportunism on the part of Cruz. But, you know, again, but it's a choice, right? These people have apparently looked at the two alternatives. They've looked at Hillary Clinton and they've looked at Donald Trump, and they've, you know, they made the calculation that, you know, despite what you may or may not like about Donald Trump and despite, you know, what you may or may not like about Hillary Clinton, on balance, Donald Trump for them is better than Hillary Clinton. And, you know, especially for politicians, again, like a Ted Cruz, not, you know, I mean, as an example, I don't know, he may have had a, the road to Damascus conversion and realized that Trump is going to be the greatest president in the world. But it does seem like opportunism. I mean, they say, well, you know, if he wins, I can't, you know, if I oppose him, then I will be persona non grata with the Trump administration. And we know how he deals with his enemies, perceived or real. Maybe if you want to have a future in the Republican Party and you think he's going to win, you better get on board, because if you don't, you will be in the wilderness for a long time.
Or on the other hand, if you perceive yourself as a potential Republican presidential candidate 4 years hence, and we actually played a clip of Reince Priebus previously, the head of the RNC, suggesting that there would be penalties levied against Republicans who had signed the pledge to support the eventual nominee and then turned around and disregarded that. I don't know how you enforce that pledge, though.
Well, yeah, any such penalties would only be, sort of moral and, you know, argumentative. I mean, they're not going to be able to do. I mean, votes are votes, and if you go out there and get the votes, there's nothing the party's going to do about it, or they can't do anything about it. But you know, I mean, there's a couple of ways to cut it, and this is again the calculations that these Republicans have to consider, because you know, again, if he wins and they're on the outs of them, then they're toast. If he loses and they've supported him, especially if he starts really imploding, I mean, if he starts down a road that, you know, over the next, what is it, 6 weeks, 5 weeks, really gets outrageous. And, you know, you never know with this guy, right? It could happen. I mean, we may have already started down that path with the last debate. But then if they've supported him, and they have this disastrous loss in November. Maybe they lose the Senate. Who knows what happens? Then you know they look bad because they they look opportunists. They've supported a guy who the country rejects wholeheartedly, and so they have to consider that. But then the other side is what if Trump loses and they're opposed to him, and then they are blamed for that loss. So say it's a close race, so he doesn't implode, he's working hard, and say he learns how to shut his mouth and stay, you know, just read what he's told to read.
And he loses Ohio, and it's John Kasich's fault.
Right. Or Florida and Bush, you know. I mean, the Bushes are a good example of the ones that seem to be sticking to their guns. I mean, they're out. They're opposed. They were opposed early. They're not. I don't think they're coming back because they're very much, in some ways, sort of Trumpian in the sense that they're sort of tribal, right? They feel like Trump denigrated one of their own, and therefore they're all going to close ranks and stomp this guy, and like they did with Saddam. So. Yeah, it's a tough one. I hate to be a Republican at this point.
We're speaking with Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined on the phone by Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. So, Chris, I didn't even ask you, what did you think of the debate?
God, I mean, it was a tough one.
I mean, I thought it was fairly interesting the first half hour. I thought it was, you know, kind of, I was actually surprised in the tone and tenor of it. It was as a debate normally is conducted, but then it just seemed to kind of go downhill from there on Trump's part.
Well, and Hillary, I mean, she really knows how to get to him. I mean, it's not hard. I mean, that's one of his problems, that his you know, his weaknesses are very apparent. His big weaknesses that he has a huge ego and he refuses to admit wrong or ignore a slight. He's got to get the last word no matter what. And with a guy like that, you know, it's not hard to push him where you want to push him. And she did it. I was listening. I guess it was on CNN, one of the lab shows the other day, and somebody asked one of the commentators, did he take the bait? And he said, well, she was more like a fly fisherman. She didn't need to chum the water. She just flicked that little, you know, that fly right exactly where she wanted, just a little bit, and he just ran with it, and he's still running with it. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, it's not very pretty. I feel sorry for the guy. Really, not coming off very well here to say, I think even in his own come as with as much denial as he has about things, he's going to be embarrassed.
So we've got the vice presidential debate coming up on Tuesday, and then we have a town hall presidential debate. Do you think the town hall kind of forum changes anything in the dynamic of the presidential debate?
Well, you know, with these two, I mean, in a normal case, yes, they have to try to, you know, to be more friendly and more down home. They look, I know who you know,
I feel your pain.
I really care about your stuff. Pardon?
I feel your pain kind of thing.
I feel your pain. I'm not going to sigh. And these two, I don't know how they're going to react to that. I mean, neither one of them are, you know, the most warm and fuzzy people that you ever met. And, you know, is that necessary? I mean, there's a, you know, the debate. Do you need to like your president? Is that somebody who's going to have a beer deal?
Well, I mean, but
that's not my criteria. I don't want to have a beer with him because it's too crowded with all the civil servants.
But
and Donald Trump might be a lot of fun to have a beer with. I mean, he reminded me of on Monday night he reminded me of my drunk uncle down at the end of the bar at the corner tap, right? A lot of fun.
Well, but do you think these debates really change anybody's mind or move anybody? Given how polarized we are.
Yes, and the research tends to show that they don't. It's a sort of a Hippocratic oath situation here, right? First, do no harm, and you don't want to really screw it up. You know, I think we'll look back historically and know if Trump really screwed this up in the first debate. I mean, I think it's a little too early to know.
I mean, Obama didn't fare well. He lost to Mitt Romney by all accounts in that first debate they had.
Right. Yeah. And but on the other, I think the first debate with McCain important for him because he was introducing himself largely, you know, not a very well known person, and he came across as measured and smart and calm, and I think that helped him a lot in people saying, well, okay, I guess I can vote for this guy. But these two are so well known to us in their own ways that I don't know. But you're right about the polarization. People, they know what they know, and that's what they know. And it's really, as are all elections, this will come down to turnout. right? Who is actually getting out to vote? It doesn't matter who says who they like to a pollster. It's like who is going to get there on election day, or, as is the case in so many places now, including Illinois, the weeks before election day, and who's actually going to get them out there. And that takes motivation, individual motivation and organization oftentimes to really get that thing going. And you look at these candidates and you say, well, on the motivation point, it strikes me that Trump's got the advantage there. I mean, he's got some really rabid followers. I don't know, you know, of the, say, 40% of the people in the country who now say they are favorite Trump, I don't know if all those 40% are rabid followers of his, but certainly there's some, and I don't know what the percentage is. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton is probably going to have the organizational advantage by a long way. They've been working on this in the traditional way for a while, whereas the Trump campaign seems to sort of be just going on it. So again, it's who, you know, who's actually going to pull those levers or fill in those Scantron dots, and we'll see.
Yeah, and I think truly that is the big question, and most definitely here in Illinois, particularly with among African American voters, because we're going to see, you know, a presidential election without the hometown president on the ballot, and how does that affect numbers for Hillary Clinton in the African American community, which is a crucial block for Democratic hopes up and down the ballot in Illinois.
Yes. And, you know, even at the presidential level, of course, what really matters, I mean, is what goes on in the Philadelphia suburbs. There's been a lot of talk about that, and I really think that's a good place to focus if you're thinking about what's going to happen in the national election, because it's also it's a good analogy for people in Illinois to understand. I mean, we've got Chicago, we've got the Collars, and then we've got downstate, and Pennsylvania is kind of split up that way too. It's also got, you know, Pittsburgh over in the corner, but Philadelphia is the big dog over there, and their suburbs are like ours, like huge, and lots of people living in them. And the swing voter, as is in Illinois, you know, is the soccer mom. Basically, it's this woman living in the suburbs, white woman by and large. Living in the suburbs, who's got kids, is fiscally conservative, but is not socially conservative. And, you know, they're concerned about security, but they, you know, they're also not, they don't want to think of themselves as racist. And so, you know, that's the kind of person that's going to decide this race. And the thing is, because Pennsylvania, if Clinton holds Pennsylvania, it's likely that she will win.
All right.
There's other combinations, but she's got to hold Pennsylvania.
Sorry, Chris. I got to hold you to that right there.
All right.
I appreciate your time this morning. Chris Mooney, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You too, Rick. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guest, Bill Ruthart, my colleague at the Tribune, Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, and Chris Mooney, my good friend, who's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Also, thanks to all of you for listening as we get ever closer to Election Day.
And
Yay!
I know.
This may be one where it's ultimately, can I survive till election day?
That's what Bill Maher was saying on his show on Real Time on Friday night, is he doesn't know if he can last for however many more days it is till November 8th.
And then, of course, I mentioned earlier, just because there's not enough going on, we have to have the President of the United States decide to return home for the weekend next weekend.
That's perfect, because there's hardly anything going on downtown with the marathon going on.
And the Cubs.
And the Cubs, exactly right.
Yeah. Good timing there.
Feeling a cold coming on for next Sunday. Hope you can stick around for 4 extra hours next week, Rick.
Thanks a lot.
Great show as always. Thank you.